It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tens of millions of Americans participate in March Madness brackets, following along with the NCAA basketball tournament with friends, co-workers, even online with sports networks. I cannot confirm nor deny that there are brackets at WESA, nor can I confirm or deny that I am the winner of the just mentioned unconfirmable brackets that might or might not have taken place here. Well, while we still don't know if the winner of the men's basketball tournament will be the Cavaliers, the Red Raiders, the Spartans, or Tigers, we do know the winner of the March Mammal Madness contest. Joining us is the curator of mammals at Carnegie Museum of Natural History, John Weibel. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
John, full disclosure, you are a fan of basketball and of mammals.
Absolutely. Basketball and mammals, of course.
Okay. This is the first year at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History that you mixed the two, if you would. But it's been going on for a few years from a professor out at Arizona State.
Yes, it started in 2013 by Dr. Katie Hind. And it's grown and grown and grown since that time period. I'm sorry to say that we didn't know about it until this year. So this is our first year of participation. And we will continue into the future because it was way too much fun for us.
Did it interrupt your business? Did it interrupt some people's business at work?
No, absolutely not. We had specific time period for March Mammal Madness during our breaks. And then we went around our business after that.
All right. If you haven't checked out the website, please do. Just like the basketball brackets where there are four regions, in Mammal Madness there are four divisions: the Waterfalls Division, the Category Division, Jump Jump, and Tag Team, where two animals are teaming up. All right, John, you're a scientist. Bachelor's and master's degree in anthropology, correct?
Correct.
PhD where?
At Duke.
All right. And that's where you sort of grew your basketball fandom.
Mm-hmm.
I know nothing beyond my high school science classes, but I'm pretty sure that sea anemone, clownfish, ants, and aphids are not mammals. Do you have any idea how they wormed their way into March Mammal Madness?
I think that the organizers were trying to extend the range of what we might think of as a mammal in some regards. Now, some of those were in there because they have a name that has a mammal thing in it.
Hmm.
So like a tiger beetle.
Oh, so that's a bit of a stretch, but okay.
Or an antlion. But I have no idea about a sea anemone. I don't think that quite fits the criteria.
All right. Well, you gotta check, and we'll see if that happens in next year's brackets. I want to know, so how did the winners, I mean, basketball, they play on the court. How did the winners advance? Was it natural selection involved?
Actually, it's done by random number generation. So it is a random act. Now, of course, someone might say that basketball is somewhat similar in terms of its randomness.
So, hold it. Scientists involved in random numbers?
What can like I say? So they had an idea of ranking because they're just like in the basketball tournaments, they have a ranking of the participants. So they came up with some idea of ranking based on certain criteria: behavior, size, temperament, speed, those kinds of things.
Okay. All right. So there was analysis there. Okay. Last year, history was made in the NCAA basketball tourney when a lowly 16 seed, UMBC, upset number one seed, Virginia. First time ever that happened. As a basketball fan, as a mammal expert, were there any equivalent upsets this year in Mammal Madness, do you think?
I would say probably 50% of them were upset because it's kind of a random generation of numbers.
Okay. So the Mammal Madness final roar included tiger, moose, sea lion, and from the tag team division, war goose, which was a warthog mongoose combination?
Correct.
Okay. Came down to tiger versus war goose, and the winner is
Bengal tiger.
You say that with pride.
Because that was my pick.
Okay.
And it pushed me over the top to win the competition.
So is that a good sign for the Auburn Tigers this weekend in the Final Four?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Actually, that might be a good sign. I would use it if I were at Auburn.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is John Weibel, curator of mammals at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. John, you're not just focusing on mammal madness. You and some colleagues are conducting new research about mammals before and after the extinction of dinosaurs. You're part of an international team. So what are you studying? What time period? What are you trying to learn?
So the dinosaurs went extinct 66 million years ago when an asteroid struck the Earth and changed the world as we know it. So prior to that 66 million years, the major animals on the planet were dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. There were mammals around, but they were living in the shadows of the dinosaurs. After that event, 66 million years ago, the dinosaurs went extinct, except for living birds, which have extended the dinosaur range.
Right.
And there was a big change because the mammals got big really fast. And so we're looking at the first 10 million years after that extinction event to try to understand why.
So they got big and new species also came about?
Absolutely. There was a whole range of new forms that appeared that you would not be able to recognize because they were very different from the things that are around today.
Is there anyone that we say maybe that survived the extinction event of the dinosaurs? Say, oh, I can see where that's an ancestor of.
Well, I mean, in a sense, yes, there are things that will be recognizable as mammals to you. Mm-hmm. But when you pull away the skin and look at the bones on the inside, they look very different. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mainly look at is the inside of those, because that's what's represented in the fossil record.
And so why is this important to you as a scientist and your colleagues of this international research team? And why is it important to us, the everyday citizen?
This has been a major problem for years for scientists. And it's taking a concerted effort of a big team to try to crack this nut of what happened in that 10-million-year time period. And why it's important to us is that we're facing similar sorts of extinction events today. Hmm. And it'd be nice to understand what were the factors that had winners and losers at that extinction event for us in our own lifetime.
Right. And so what is your time frame? Do you have a timeline on this research and your ultimate goal?
Well, we have a grant that's funded by the National Science Foundation for 4 years. So that's the overarching time frame that we're working in. I don't know if we're going to be able to have all the results that we'd like to have during that time period. So it might stretch out a little bit beyond that.
All right. John, this year's March Mammal Madness has just ended, but I'm a huge fan of dinosaurs. Can you maybe get some of your paleontologist colleagues at the museum to do a dinosaur version? And I even got a name for it.
And what would that be?
Dino Delirium. What do you think?
I love it. I will talk to the curator of dinosaurs the next time that I see him.
All right. John Weibel is curator of mammals at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. You can find out more information about the museum and March Mammal Madness at their website. We'll have a link up on our website. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence.
Hugh Masekela was born 80 years ago today in South Africa. He began playing trumpet at the age of 14 and by the 1950s was performing in the now legendary band, the Jazz Epistles. In 1960, at the age of 21, Masekela left his home and moved to New York City, where he found himself immersed in the jazz scene. At the end of the 1960s, Masekela moved to Los Angeles and found himself in the middle of the summer of love. He became friends with the hippies and even performed at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. The next year, his song Grazin' in the Grass hit number one, making him a true international success. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. According to the Education Department, more than half of Allegheny County school districts are suffering from racial achievement gaps. Factors like socioeconomics and implicit teacher bias are affecting the issue. Ahead, how some local school districts are trying to shrink the gap. Do you know someone with a perspective or project worth sharing? What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm or leave us a voicemail at 412-315-6778. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
What's behind the decline in insect populations around the world? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple. There have been some pretty alarming headlines recently about butterflies and other insects. Mass extinction and apocalypse have been mentioned. According to a recent study, 3/4 of flying insects in nature reserves across Germany have disappeared over the last 25 years. And scientists studying a rainforest in Puerto Rico have reported astonishing losses of insects on the ground, a 98% loss over 35 years. John Wenzel is a career entomologist and director of Powdermill Nature Reserve, which is part of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. We sat down at the museum to talk about what's happening.
Is the situation as dire as these stories suggest?
I don't think we can really say that yet. Some of the situations really are terrible crisis. Other ones we're just discovering. We don't really know how bad they are. The research needs to be compared to something else. Also, when we talk about loss, there are two kinds of loss. There's a loss where the species disappears completely, and then there's a loss where they're just not as frequent as they were. And both of those are important to measuring this crisis.
These stories are not necessarily telling the full picture of what's happening.
Right. It certainly is more complicated than any of the sort of simple cries to arms make it out to be. The two studies you mentioned, I think, are important for very different reasons. In the German study, what they found was even within protected nature reserves, there's this collapse. What this means is our nature reserves aren't working. And apparently the human environment around the margin of the reserve is enough to degrade the preserved area so it isn't functioning properly anymore. That should be a great concern. The study from Puerto Rico is rather different. That seems to be the result of climate change, where the rainy and dry seasons have changed a little bit. These forest insects, they're disappearing because the wet forest is drying out.
We've mentioned climate change. What do we know about why population declines are happening in different regions?
Different regions, of course, have different causes of decline. One of the things that's been observed, particularly in Britain, is the abandonment of the family farm. And we can probably measure this in Eastern North America, too. Family farms are actually pretty good places sometimes for wildlife because the edge of the field provides a place for weeds and little places for animals to live, and they often have water all year round. And now we've done away with those, and we have gigantic monoculture that's industrial. That's a very different landscape. A lot of these changes are probably catching up with us all at once.
Can you just say a little more about the impact of insects on ecosystem?
Yeah, once in a while people will say to me something like, oh, I heard somehow that insects will inherit the world. And I say, not really, because it's already theirs. The entire terrestrial ecosystem relies ultimately on plants, fundamentally, and then the next step is insects. The insects either pollinate the plants or control the weeds, or they simply feed on these leaves and then a bird eats the insect that eats the leaves. If you were to remove the insects, the ecosystem that we know, particularly here in Eastern North America, for instance, that ecosystem would collapse in a year or two. Without those insects, essentially every fundamental process in terrestrial ecosystems would fail. Leaves would fall to the ground and they wouldn't turn into soil anymore. They'd just be dead leaves on the ground. Everything that you think of would be disrupted.
John Wenzel is director of Powdermill Nature Reserve. And there's more about wildlife conservation at AlleghenyFront.org/wildPA. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to Pennsylvania's Department of Education, more than half of the school districts in Allegheny County have achievement gaps. What are the factors leading to the disparity in classroom performance? Joining us in studio is Mary Niederberger, education reporter for PublicSource.org, and Dr. William Short, superintendent of the Gateway School District. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks, Kevin.
Mary, I'm going to start with you. What drew you to your work studying disparities in student achievement?
So I used to do this when we were under the old system, the No Child Left Behind system.
Right.
The state always reported the test scores along racial lines. And when we moved away from that in 2012, for some reason, the state decided not to do that anymore. They lumped all what they considered to be the predictably underachieving students, economically disadvantaged, right. ESL, minority, into one lump. And so for 5 years, we had no reporting on this. And when the state unveiled the Future Ready PA Index in November, they made a point of saying, we've returned to doing this along racial lines. And so we dug in. I mean, it took us a while to create all the spreadsheets and, right. and come up with the gaps. But I had been waiting to do this story for 5 years.
Right. So one or two key points you found from that data, and then we'll expand on them.
That overwhelmingly, you know, more than half of the schools in Allegheny County had achievement gaps, a lot of them double-digit percentage points. And there could be more. This is what's getting lost. You have to have at least 20 students in a school in order for it to be measurable.
20
black students, okay. Right. In order to have the data be a measurable group. And so there could be many other schools that aren't listed who, if you took whatever minority students they had and looked at their data, there's also a gap there as well.
Bill, as a superintendent, were you surprised by any of the data that has been uncovered?
I think initially, yes, we were surprised back in the No Child Left Behind days. But examining that data, we knew we had to develop a plan for improvement to reach just not only African-American students, but all students in general. And over the course of the last 10 years, we've been able to systematically put in place a plan to attack students educationally, all students, but including the African-American subgroup as well. And the results have been surprising, but based on the plan and the data and the research that we've been able to do, internally we're not surprised because we know we have excellent teachers. And if we could reach those kids, we know we could break through.
All right. So give us a little snapshot of your district. Mm-hmm. The gap, is it in all of the schools in the Gateway District?
Inherently, it was in all of the schools. However, over the last 3 to 4 years, we've been breaking that down within the elementary schools, but also periodically year to year because it's a cohort-based system. Every year, the state will judge an 11th grade class or an elementary group of kids, 3, 4, 5, and 6, as they take the assessment.
Right.
So what we've been able to do is see that with a third grade class from 3 to 4 years ago that we've instituted targeted accelerated group learning, culturally biased reform efforts, we've been able to track this virtual cohort of students and follow them through the last 4 years of data, and it is equal in achievement with our white students.
The state data indicates 5 districts, Northgate, McKeesport, Penn Hills, East Allegheny, and Gateway, had double-digit mm-hmm. achievement gaps in schools. Mary, you report that several school districts with wide gaps have not commented, at least to you and publicsource.org. Were any of these districts maybe a surprise because of their reputation as a good school district?
So the biggest surprise to me was in Fox Chapel, where there was a very wide racial achievement gap at their middle school. And I was also surprised that there was no comment from them, because in my years covering education, they generally are responsive to things. The day after the story ran, the superintendent put a statement on their district webpage saying it was an important story and he was aware of the gap and they were working on it. But he didn't comment for the story. The other districts, I guess I wasn't surprised just because I did see, you know, some high achieving districts that had these gaps. I was surprised that there were superintendents who chose to just completely not talk. Some ignored the requests. North Hills said they would take a pass. They didn't want to talk about it. And I was surprised by all that.
Bill, you did talk to Mary. Why did you choose to talk to her?
Absolutely. When Mary reached out to the Gateway School District, my office, I jumped on it immediately. I felt this was an opportunity to, A, validate, but also have an outside lens, take a look at what we're doing to see if, in fact, this is something that other school districts could imitate or mirror what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about school districts, but Mary, how does charter schools compare? Any surprising things there?
So the charter school story followed the story about the traditional schools. And what we found in the charter schools were, there were two surprises for me. One, well, in the traditional school districts, I didn't find any place where there was a measurable black subgroup where the black students outscored the white students. But in the charters, I did. At Propel McKeesport, in English language arts, the black students outscored the white students. So that was surprising. That was a difference. And they think there it's because they've had less turnover in staff, less turnover with the students, and so they're able to build relationships. The other difference with the charter schools is more of the charter schools than the traditional schools were overwhelmingly African American. So there was no gap, but their scores were pretty low. So to me, that's a racial gap as well.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about new data on the racial achievement gap and addressing underlying causes. Mary, you worked with University of Pittsburgh researcher Dana Thompson Dorsey on the data behind the racial achievement gaps. Her staff at Pitt is also in charge of the implicit bias and cultural relevance professional development that is going on in some of the local schools. She talked with The Confluence's Mick Stanelli earlier this week.
A lot of our communities are segregated, similar to how our schools are segregated. So what happens is you have children who grow up in certain communities and they hardly ever see people who look different than they do or who act differently than they do. And when I say different, and it's going to be based on gender, race, ethnicity, ability, class, and we start to build up these biases based on these direct and indirect exposure in our socialization. So once we're adults, if we're not addressing the biases that we have, those biases remain, particularly if we have not exposed ourselves to people who are different than us and have not socialized with people who are different than us. And so teachers are not immune from that. Let's use the example. I'm going to use the example of a black teacher because it's so easy to rely on white teachers having biases against black students. And let's say a black teacher who has grown up living in a community that maybe is predominantly white, has been well educated in schools that may be racially mixed, but maybe because of their socialization as being a young person, may be more comfortable with people who are white. And on a regular basis, hears things on television, either in passing or even when directly watching or reading things in the news or seeing things in social media or hearing conversations happening next to you or around you or near you, are always talking about how bad black children are, how they're not raised right, how their parents aren't well educated, don't value education. You as that black teacher may go in with your own biases because of how you've been socialized, because of what your brain has taken in terms of things that have been said about people that you're not used to being around, that you have not been exposed to and gotten to know the variations and differences and nuances that occur with different people and different people of color. So you go in with those biases and automatically some of those things you've heard about black children come to the forefront of your mind because that's all you've been exposed to and socialized to know. So implicit bias is something that affects everybody. But when you think about teachers, whether they're black, white, Native American, Latino, they go into schools and have certain assumptions about their students, the children that they teach, based on their own socialization. And if that is not addressed in terms of challenging those biases, what those biases may be will be reflected in how you treat your students, how you interact with your students, in a relationship that you build or do not build with your students.
What would you say would be the first step to addressing those biases and getting teachers to examine their own biases?
Well, I think first understanding what it is, learning that it's not just you, that we all deal with it, recognizing that there's certain stressors, which teachers often have a lot of stress. Because of these standardized tests, because of all the demands on their time in the classroom and even outside of the classroom. And those stressors can also bring out those biases more often. So knowing these things and then trying to address challenging them, put yourself in a position where you're socializing more with those you have biases against so that you can get to know them as human beings and people as opposed to a statistic or something you heard about on a television or in social media. So it is something that you have to constantly challenge on a daily basis or why you assume or have certain assumptions about people. That's the best way to do it, is exposure to really challenge what you think or assuming about people you don't know anything about.
That's University of Pittsburgh researcher Dana Thompson-Darcy. Bill, your district, Gateway, has been taking steps, and I believe including the implicit bias training?
That is correct. We've had University of Pittsburgh Center for Urban Education and Professional Development over the last 2 years. We've been able to in-service our staff K-12 across the board.
Mm-hmm. How big of an issue is it that most of the teachers in our schools do not look like a lot of their students? In other words, most of the teachers in our schools are white.
Mm-hmm.
That's been listed as a big issue anytime I write about this. Even last year, we did some series with the Pittsburgh Public Schools about suspensions and access to gifted programs. Mm-hmm. And that comes up every time, that the majority of teachers are white, and of the majority of white teachers, they're female. And it's constantly mentioned as a factor in how black students and other students of color are treated in the classroom.
Bill, are you trying to get a greater diversity in your faculty?
When we interview, we're not specifically looking for a person of color or, you know, anyone in particular, but it's important that we understand that we're getting the best educator in that system. And it's important that we also understand that the biggest thing a teacher can do is get to know their students. Mm-hmm. And once they get to know their students, the trust factor is important. We're fortunate at Gateway that we do have a higher percentage of African-American teachers as compared to other school districts around Western Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. There's a school of thought that I've heard that it's not an achievement gap, it's a test score gap, and the teachers are not to blame, and that the tests themselves are biased.
We look at that as an opportunity gap, not an achievement gap, because every student comes into our building sometimes not afforded the opportunities that their counterparts may have. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what Mary was saying, and I referenced this term, zip code education. Some kids have been afforded the ability to have tutors, been read to at an earlier age, been exposed to different venues, museums, pieces of art, where our kids and some other kids may be coming into a school district and they haven't been exposed to that. So it's important that we get them, know where they're at, take a pulse in their education with diagnostic assessments, and then determine how do we remediate those students.
Socioeconomics have long been pointed to as a factor in an achievement gap, in a test score gap. Mary, what other factors did you find out about maybe that are affecting even with inside the school building?
Yeah, so Dana actually is the one who focused in on this. I sent her my spreadsheets, and she looked at the top, and she looked at the school district that had the largest gap, and it happened to be Steel Valley at the high school and the middle school. And she immediately went and looked up their disciplinary rates and their attendance rates and found out there was a big disparity between the number of black students being suspended versus what they make up in the population, and that there was a big difference in the regular attendance rates from black students to white students. And, you know, she said that's what you find nationally. She when she went looking, she found exactly what she expected to find. Mm-hmm. So it's about creating an atmosphere in the school where the minority students feel comfortable and engaged. The other thing is creating culturally relevant lessons. I sat in on Center for Urban Education Professional Development at Woodland Hills, where some social studies teachers sat in groups and brainstormed ways to make their lessons, to teach history in particular, mm-hmm. not through the lens that we always do, but through a lens that the minority students could relate to.
Bill, you were nodding about culturally relevant curriculum.
Absolutely. Culturally responsive pedagogy, it's something that we also examine whenever we're looking at updating our curriculum, resources, and materials. We have parents, we have teachers that sit on committees whenever there's a presentation taking place, and we ask for their input, and we have them provide us with information related to a specific textbook, company, or resource that is it culturally relevant mm-hmm. to what our district is looking for.
Okay. Less than 2 minutes, and I wanted to ask you, what about expectations? Have they changed for students as far as have certain students had expectations lowered for them?
expectations are high for every child that walks in the doors at Gateway. Absolutely, they're very high.
Mary?
I think that's what Bill's doing at Gateway, but that was listed by a number of the experts that this is where the implicit bias comes in. If you have a minority child who hasn't been achieving, you don't expect them to, and you don't expect as much out of them, and that could lead to a self-fulfilling prophecy of that child performing at a lower level than other children.
Right. In a couple sentences each, our last question. So what's needed to eliminate the gap, shrink the gap in the district or in districts in general? Just a couple sentences.
At Gateway, we reference these three terms, curriculum, instruction, and assessment. And if you have all of those three independently working for every child in our district, we'll see results and success. But it's also important to understand that every student is different when they walk in the door, depending upon where they're at on a pendulum with learning.
Mary?
I think educators recognizing the experience of the minority students in the classroom and what needs to be done to make their experience more engaging and relevant to them, and look at discipline through a different lens.
Mary Niederberger is an education reporter for PublicSource.org. Bill Short is the superintendent of the Gateway School District. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, transitioning to a new job or a whole new career path can be challenging. Maybe it means learning new tech or joining an environment that doesn't offer obvious paths to mentorship or training. Tomorrow, a conversation with Pennsylvania Women Work about how a few cups of coffee can help people find meaningful, sustainable employment. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Mick Stanelli, Joe Yazankovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of the program is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.